Hello. Russian aggression in Eastern Europe, the plight of the invaded peoples causing anguish amongst those watching on in the West, and a sense of fundamental reordering of the continent's security dynamics and its paradigm shifting implications for the rest of the world. Today's invasion of Ukraine carries more than just echoes of the fighting in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in the 1790s, or indeed the contested nation-state of Poland all the way through the 1792 to 1815 period. I hardly imagined when I spoke to Adam Zamoyski about his forebears' struggles against Russia that we'd be putting these episodes out against the backdrop of another bloody war in Europe. Well, we recorded a special Ukraine quarterly bonus episode to consider the parallels between the conflicts then and now, not to mention the lessons that one has for the other, back in May last year. And we always held open the possibility that we might try a similar exercise. And indeed now it does feel like a good time to have another go with the possibility of a Russian spring offensive now very much on the cards. At the end of each episode of the Napoleonic Quarterly, we imagine what it would have been like at the end of each quarter, considering what questions might be being asked as things had progressed by that particular stage, by that particular date. There's no need to imagine those question marks now as we're living through a similar situation, as we wonder how events will progress in the coming weeks and months in Eastern Europe today. It's a strange feeling. It's an uncomfortable feeling. It's one we're getting used to as the conflict enters its second year. And indeed, it's to mark the first anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine that we can now offer listeners another Ukraine Quarterly, not a blow-by-blow account of the fighting, but rather an opportunity for a discussion from the point of view of historians working with more than one foot in the 1792 to 1815 period. In a moment, I'll hand over the floor to our chair for today's episode, Alexander Mikhaburidze, Professor of History at Louisiana State University, Shreveport. Alex lives and works in the United States, but his roots are Georgian, and his heart is certainly with Ukrainians fighting not just for their survival, but for the survival of all the post-Soviet countries in the region. His recent biography of Field Marshal Kutuzov described the life and times of a man who still commands an aura of respect and even reverence from not just Russians, but many of the other countries who, many of those from the other countries who follow the period all over the world, really. On Alex's panel today is our old friend, Charles Esdale, Professor Emeritus at the University of Liverpool, who continues to offer so much as we try and make sense of the tide of events from 1792 to 1815. Great to have you with us, Charles. And finally, it's a great pleasure and a great delight to welcome Simon Sebag Montefiore to the podcast. Simon's the author of both history books and novels with the grand narratives of history at their heart. Catherine the Great, Potemkin, the Romanovs, and Stalin have all passed under his consideration, whilst his Russian trilogy of novels, culminating in the celebrated One Night in Winter, have received widespread recognition. He's as much a historian of space as time, as reflected in his BBC documentaries about all sorts of very different, very striking places: Jerusalem, Rome, Istanbul, Vienna, for example. So I must say, I, for one, I'm looking forward to this conversation very much. I'm going to sit back and listen along with the rest of you for the second in our Ukraine Quarterly series. So from one Alex to another Alex, over to you.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. Simon suggested that we call each other Alex the First and Alex the Second. So I'm claiming you're Alex the First.
And you're Charles the First.
No, Charles are terrible.
Charles are terrible.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Simon. It is truly a delight, especially I think for me, since I've followed your work for so long, and I'm teaching a Russian imperial history this semester, and my students and I, we are rereading your Romanov book, and I think much of our conversation will be centered around, you know, the themes that you've touched in this book. Earlier this morning, before I came and kind of on the podcast, I was reading Financial Times, and I know you've probably read that article that appeared in the newspaper, written by Max Sedon, Christopher Miller, and Felicia Schwartz about the blunt kind of the situation inside the Kremlin. a year ago as the decision was made by Vladimir Putin to go into Ukraine. And one of the things that struck me is an exchange that the journalists recounted based on interviews with oligarchs, where one of the oligarchs, astonished by the decision, goes to the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, and asks him, how could Putin do such a thing, such a decision, without listening to his senior advisors? And Lavrov, and I love that kind of passage of it, he replied, Putin has only three advisors, Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great. So I want to, I think, start our conversation and ask you first, what do you think about that passage? What about this quote and kind of the historical thinking of these three rulers, Ivan, Peter, and Catherine, as the advisors for Putin?
Well, I mean, I perhaps I'll start with that, if you don't mind, Charles. But I mean, I think what's fascinating about it is just the way. I mean, first of all, you know, the imperial mindset of Putin. I mean, many people were writing about this sort of attitude before February a year ago, and we were all slightly kind of mocked. And you know, I often sort of said about Putin, you know, he's really fascinated in this imperial mindset, in this imperial state of mind. And of course, seeing the Soviet Union as an imperial Russian state, which many people did, of course, by the late Soviet Union, even by the middle Soviet Union, in fact. And of course, just seeing the Russian Federation today as a sort of stunted empire that needs rebuilding. But when I talked to people about that idea and wrote about it in the Romanov book, I was always being lectured by people that knew much better, and this was very unlikely. And basically, Russian people just wanted to send their children to English public schools and live in Chelsea and all this kind of thing, and this would never happen. So it's interesting that it has happened. And of course, you know, Putin just looks at Russian history in a very simplistic way, and in a way that he just seeks the successful rulers. So, you know, he's the only Soviet ruler he's really interested in is Stalin. But, you know, then he goes back into history and looks at Ivan the Terrible and looks at Peter. I mean, Catherine's an interesting example because, of course, she's a woman, she's a German, and so she doesn't quite fit in with the nationalistic and very sort of chauvinistic and macho swagger of this particular regime, with its hostility to you know, homosexual rights, you know, gay rights, and all this sort of thing. But of course, also, you know, she's the odd one out really in this, because she was such a child of the Enlightenment. But I think you may know this, Alexander the First. But when I wrote that first book, Catherine the Great and Potemkin, all those 21 years ago now, you know, I was approached by Putin's people then, and Putin was just this new. I mean, I'd never really heard of him, except as a sort of quite minor cabinet minister who'd run the security organs for a very short time. And I was approached and asked about this, and they said to me, you know, we want to base the regime on Catherine the Great. We're looking to Catherine the Great. And I saw this as a hopeful sign, because I felt that they were looking at her as a reformer, as a child of the Enlightenment. But what they asked for was, first of all, you know, how she conquered, how she annexed Crimea and how she and South Ukraine. But secondly, they said, you know, about Potemkin, could he be the basis for the regime? Could he be an example? Could we use him as a model for a new sort of presidency of the Russian Federation? And they asked me to write a one-pager about this, which is kind of interesting. And later I was told by his deputy minister of culture, who was my publisher in Russia, that Putin had read the book. And he had a reward for me, which was access. Would I like access to Stalin's papers, which became my book, Stalin, according to the Red Tsar. But what's interesting about the story is that this interest in Catherine and Potemkin was 20 over 20 years ago. And at the time, Western leaders all regarded Putin as a sort of liberal reformer. So that was interesting. And I guess I didn't quite pick up at the time on the imperial nature of this appetite for South Ukraine and Crimea.
Well, let me ask you kind of a follow up, maybe. Is that Catherine, to me, Catherine and Peter, is an interesting choice here as kind of as historical advisors, considering that the core theme of Peter and Catherine's reforms were westernization, or at least closer integration within the wider European systems. And in that sense, Putin is the very undoing of Peter's and Catherine's legacy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, that's the fascinating thing about Peter. Though, of course, Peter as a sort of pro-Western reformer, I mean, he wasn't so much pro-Western. He just wanted Western technology, particularly in artillery and shipbuilding. So, you know, in order to build up Russia as a great power, as an imperial power. But Catherine was much more interested in the West. I mean, there are certain Russian rulers that are sort of do see themselves more as European than sort of Slavophile Russians. And I suppose those would be Catherine, Alexander I to a certain extent, and Alexander II as well. Those are the sort of rulers who kind of identified as Europeans, I think. And all of them were disappointed in certain ways. I mean, Catherine wanted to be sort of part of Europe. But of course, at the last minute in 1791, when they got Otchakov on the Black Sea and they started to take the Black Sea coast, Britain and Prussia, Pitt the Younger, turned on them and tried to stop them. And so I think she ended with a slightly different view, and which to some extent explains why she sort of, you know, why she sort of was happy just to sort of savage Poland in those last years. But you know, so I think you're right. I mean, you're right that there is a big difference. And Catherine the Great, you know, Catherine is an interesting choice for this. But of course, it's because of Ukraine. It's because of South Ukraine and Crimea. And that's all to do with Potemkin and these towns. And of course, the irony is, you know, all the cities that are really being fought for or coveted, you know, Sebastopol, Mariupol, Odessa, Dnipro, all these places, Mykolaiv as it is now, Kherson, of course, all of them are now being kind of destroyed by Putin if he gets the chance. And they're all Potemkin and Catherine's, the cities that they founded.
Charles, what are your thoughts about this?
I too have been much struck by the inclusion of Peter the Great amongst Putin's heroes, because, I mean, as Simon has told us, and, you know, we think of him as a westernizer. What comes over to me, though, very strongly is the whole business of, you know, throughout Russian history, whether in terms of the rulers or in terms of their senior advisors and members of the intelligentsia and so forth, you've always had this struggle between Easterners and Westerners. Positions which, you know, whose definition vary according to the historical period. And it seems to me that this is a period when, if you like, the Easterners are on top, big time. Incidentally, to the list of Westerners amongst the Tsars, I might possibly controversially add Paul I, because Paul I actually reacted quite strongly against his mother's regime. He regarded the Russian army as a force which had been allowed to run down by Catherine, which had been allowed to sort of fall into sloppy Slavic ways and wear sloppy Slavic uniforms and should be remodeled on the forces of Frederick the Great. But that's by the by. I mean, But certainly it is this context of the constant struggle between we are Russians and there is a Russian way, and we are Russians, but we need to integrate with Europe and follow European models. Constant struggle.
If Chuck, if we're adding Paul to that list, we should add Peter the Third, of course, for exactly the same reason. And I think it's a valid, it's a very valid point. And I think the Eastern, you know, the triumph of the Easterners, if we're looking at that now, part of that is to do, of course, with, you know, the huge kind of shift towards China, and, you know, which is one explanation, not the only one, but one explanation for the sort of Eurasian idea of this regime. And which is, of course, you know, I mean, this regime is increasingly dependent on China, and that means a certain sort of shift looking east rather than west for a start. But I do think on Peter the Great, I mean, we always think of the Western, you know, the West, the visits to Holland and Britain and France, the move into Germany, the conversion of Poland into a sort of satellite state, which was the result of Poltava. But I also think you've got to remember what happened in Ukraine, and you know, in the Swedish campaign, in the Charles XII's invasion, you know, when Mazepa changed sides, having been really close to Peter, and friendly at court, and then backed the Swedes, obviously hoping for a sort of independent hetmanate, and was completely destroyed by Menshikov, who kind of galloped in and destroyed his capital at Baturin and just laid waste to that territory. So I'm sure that's what if Putin really is thinking a lot about Peter the Great, that's one thing that he's thinking about, because that is entirely parallel to what's happening today, if you like. I mean, he would see Mazepa as Ukraine, Mazepa, you know, backing the advancing Western power, the Swedes in this case, against Russia, and being destroyed for it. So there is in the Peter the Great story, there is an exact sort of exact parallel.
In your Romanov book, you have kind of the backbone of the narrative is this theme on the nature of autocracy, with its daily power struggles, kind of succession troubles, plots, and so on. But I love a passage in the book where you describe kind of your approach as a study of character and the distorting effect of absolute power. So looking, and you've written on Stalin in addition to Romanov's, can you kind of draw parallels on the study of character and distorting effect of absolute power to modern reality?
Well, I mean, I think one point is that, you know, just about any politician, even if they're in an English or American or French democracy, they all go mad after 10 years in power. And anything more than 10 years is probably a bad idea. You know, they all begin to show slight signs of a sort of megalomaniacal befuddlement, and that's the best of them. So, you know, Russian, you know, all of us have studied Russian power, and you know, it has life within the Kremlin within the Winter Palace does create a special mentality. It changes people, and partly it's the absolutism of power. Partly it's the fact that everyone lies to you immediately and no one can tell you the truth. Partly it's the fact that your position, I mean, one of the key factors I think is often forgotten about Russian imperial power or presidential power, autocratic power, is that, of course, we look at it from our point of view and we just look up and we're seeing this kind of these people with absolute power over life and death. And we think that's in some way an enviable position for a politician, but I always, because I have my books, the studies of power from the try to be studies of power from the inside. You know, there's also the fact that Russian power has no structure. There's no succession really, And of course, that changed in the Russian imperial family after Paul I, when he brought in that, you know, this a different succession law, where basically banned female succession effectively, and sort of adopted primogeniture. But before then, there was no system of succession, and of course, after 1917, there was no system of succession either in the Soviet Union, and of course, in the presidency. Today, there's no way that these leaders can really retire ever. I mean, they probably don't want to. I mean, it's very addictive to be in power, but also it's almost impossible to retire without some sort of deal with your successor. And you don't necessarily know who your successor is going to be or who they're going to turn out to be. So these are real problems. I mean, the great advantages of autocracy, which we see in the case of people like Peter the Great, or in the case of someone like Nicholas I and Putin. You know, for 20 years, those two managed to sort of outwit Western clumsy, slow Western democracies led by cautious, slightly managerial people, and which is of course the wonderful thing about democracy. It's why we want to live in them. Because they're often led by somewhat harmless characters, while, you know, in autocracies you have this system where with no real public opinion you can make these decisions very quickly. You can decide on the spur of the moment to go into Syria or to invade, to retake Chechnya or to occupy Crimea, for example. And there were many examples under Nicholas I, where he constantly outplayed England and Britain and France because he could make decisions instantly. Well, the trouble with democracies is they're terribly inconsistent. They change government sometimes every 5 years. But in Britain lately, and in Victorian England and in the early 19th century England, they sometimes change government every 3 weeks or 3 months. So, which, by the way, is interesting, isn't it? Because we always think of, you know, we think of what's happening in Britain now as a sign of a kind of failed state. But of course, Britain at its very, very, it is absolute apogee, was just as unstable in terms of governments changing and falling. But anyway, the problem with the autocratic system, of course, then is that the people who are autocrats become sclerotic, isolated, they're misinformed. And so there reaches a point where they're suddenly actually become a big problem, and they become they're damaged people. And this happened, of course, to Stalin as well. I mean, his decisions after 1945, when he made many mistakes before, but he made even more mistakes afterwards. You know, the Korean War, maybe, you know, the 1948, the blockade, and there are other things too. So they just become less and less capable. And you can see that with Putin. And that's pretty typical. It happened with Nicholas I in exactly the same way. I mean, the Crimean War was completely unnecessary, self-inflicted, unforced error by him, totally out of arrogance. And you see that with Putin with this war as well, that, you know, he didn't need to have this war, but he felt that he was so successful that he could pull it off. He believed his own myth. But really his successes were based on very minor, you know, minor military campaigns and quite easy. I mean, you know, he took over the Syrian civil war, big deal. No one was that keen to take on Syria, you know. Crimea, no one stopped him. I mean, I think this is a controversial opinion. I'd love to know what you both think of this. And I mean, I think that if he'd taken all of Ukraine in 2014, he might have got away with it.
I think he had a better chance of it. And certainly, I think, as a Georgian, I have to remind the listeners about 2008 war, I think the weak response from the West to that violation of a sovereignty of another state certainly lit up a green light for Crimea, for events of 2022. So there is, as you pointed out, is that it's not as much it is as much Putin exploiting the Western complacency as it is the weakness or the lack of desire to confront. In fact, in my own kind of talks, one of the I put a lion's share of the blame for this at the feet of the German Chancellor Merkel. I remember how lionized she was when she retired, and then I was criticizing her. People like Simon, you are mentioning that people were gonna criticizing you for making critical comments about Putin. I was speaking out about Merkel's failure to really confront the problems within Russia. In fact, cultivating this closeness or relationship. So one of the I think culprits in the affairs that we're dealing with in Ukraine is Germany. And there has to be a reassessment, and I'm sure there will be a historical reassessment of Merkel's role in all of this. Charles.
2014 and all that. On one level, yes, there wasn't a whole lot stopping Putin from doing whatever he wanted. Irresolution in the West, the Ukrainian armed forces in disarray and so forth. However, part of me says that the Russians would actually have made a dreadful mess of things. Actually, what they engaged in 2014 was again fairly limited operations. They took the Crimea and they took a relatively small part of the eastern Ukraine. Had we seen them pushing on and fanning out across the whole of the Ukraine, I think that supply lines would have broken down. I think discipline would have broken down. I think that the whole thing would have turned into a gigantic mess.
What I'm saying is I think logistically, yes, challenges would have been there, maybe as bad as nowadays. But on the Ukrainian side, what we're seeing here is the Ukrainian army that had 8 years to prepare for this conflict. 8 years of changes, innovations, kind of thinking through the possibilities, something that would not have been present in 2014, especially because this would have happened in the context of a political polarization within Ukraine. Euromaidan is fresh. Who knows how? I think, as I said, Putin had a better chance of gaining ground in Ukraine in 2014. Giving Ukraine 8 years was, fortunately for us, for everyone else, a mistake.
I think that's right, because I think Charles is absolutely right that it would have been a total mess. But I think a total mess wouldn't have mattered so much, because Ukraine really had a minimal military force in 2014. Firstly, the West would have been completely confused about what to do. And there was one other thing that is really important because of the circumstances of 2014. There was actually a legitimate elected Ukrainian president who had been overthrown, of course, by a popular uprising. But he was actually the elected president. There was a sort of argument. I mean, they actually had then a sort of argument. They had someone they could claim had been elected. So I think it might have worked. Anyway, the point is he didn't have the courage of his convictions to do it then. And I think part of it is he was still, even though we've kind of agreed that he was kind of more Eastern looking than Western looking, he was still sort of plugged into the Western, to the international system, shall we say. But I think it was COVID that really, and I was talking about isolation. And of course, one of the features of these autocracies is you talk to fewer and fewer people. And also the old kind of veterans who you come up with, they fall by the wayside, they get ill. And of course, I mean, illness is one thing that is very relevant in power, because the one thing these people can't control is health. And obviously the regime depends on the life of one man. And the fact is that autocratic power is punishing on health, on the stress, the life is a very tough life. All politics is, and Anyway, I think that the COVID, the 3 years in COVID, where Putin is just in a tiny group of people, he's lost a lot of those, that original group, that original entourage that comes with him from Petersburg. And he's really only got Patrushev left, you know, of those people. And I just think he's just very isolated. He's talking to about three people and he's reading too much history, which is a very bad idea for dictators to read, especially if it's concentrated on one subject.
Yeah, and especially I think one of the fascinating tidbits in the Financial Times article was the journalist pointing out kind of a group of people that Putin consults, and it's a small group as you mentioned. And one of the members of this small group is Yuri Kovalchuk and also his brother Mikhail. And both of these Kovalchuks are interesting because of their kind of belief and hardcore belief in Russian imperial revanchism, right? Revival of this imperial construct. So if you are dealing with people, with a few kind of small group of people on a daily basis, and they are the ones who are talking about the imperial revanchism, it cannot but kind of put up a certain viewpoint. And in your book, I think you have a fascinating kind of passage there where you talk about the nature of power as this, I think the quote is the mysterious, invisible alchemy of personality, fear, and authority. And I love that quote because I think it goes to the very heart of the situation we're dealing with in Kremlin nowadays. And indeed, that kind of alchemy of personality, fear, and authority.
Yeah. I mean, I think, oh yeah, Charles, sorry, I'll let you speak first.
Yeah, thank you. I was thinking about what you said about Putin having more of a political cause in 2014 because Yanukovych had been overthrown and so forth. I was thinking more about the nature of Ukrainian nationalism. The Ukrainian nationalism of 2014 was very much the old style Ukrainian nationalism, which you've seen operating ever since Ukraine became independent. And it has to be said that there were some glaring weaknesses in that. Above all, a tendency, and I know this is something I flagged up in our previous episode, our previous discussion. It's something I flag up on Twitter constantly. But the trouble is that there was this fascination with that ghastly fellow Stepan Bandera, and the OUN of the Second World War. Bandera had recently been made a hero of Ukraine. There was a statue of Bandera which was erected in Lviv, and the fact of the matter is that the Bandera was a Nazi. He was a self-proclaimed national socialist, and that fascination with a very, very, very dubious role model was deeply damaging. It remains deeply damaging. The difference is that Zelensky represents a break from the past. He represents a break from that tradition. He's somebody who actually tried very hard to find a political solution to the problem of the Donbass. He is somebody who has actually publicly condemned the wearing of effectively Nazi insignia. There was a march in Moscow in 2021, about April or May 2021, when a big crowd of demonstrators marched through the city celebrating what is for some reason called the embroidery festivity or the embroidery day. But the point is that they marched through Kiev bearing the badge. It's a blue shield with a yellow lion on it. Of the Galicia Waffen-SS division. Apparently those marches had already been happening in places like Lviv for some time. So in other words, the Ukrainian regime of today, the Ukrainian nationalist regime, is with all this problem, which I do believe it has to address, is much stronger than the Ukrainian nationalism of 2014. It is a nationalism which is, shall we say, more in tune with Western values. Anyway, enough for me.
No, I think that's pretty interesting because one of the things I've tried to do in my world, but my latest book is a history of the world called The World, a Family History. And thank you, Alexander. And one of the things I try to do in it is I think we do Ukraine today a disservice by kind of laundering the past and taking out Bandera and what happened in the 30s and 40s and World War II and the Holocaust. And I don't see any reason to take it out. So what I've tried to do in this book is to show that, you know, we can support democratic Ukraine in today and since Zelensky, but also since 2014, and without hiding this stuff. I think in the press and on Twitter, people are very frightened to talk about this stuff now. They don't want to put their foot in it and be cancelled. But actually, you know, there's no reason to hide it. And you're right that since Zelensky rarely represents a new sort of nationalism and a new sort of national consciousness. I do think it's been improving since 2014 radically anyway, as Charles says. But in the World Book, I have both.
I have been very, very forthright on Twitter, hammering home the point over and over again that Ukraine must confront its past, that Zelensky must act to root out the cult of Stepan Bandera, that Bandera's statue must be torn down, that every street name, every street named after him must be given a new name, and so on and so forth. I believe very strongly that in taking that line, I am actually fighting for the future of Ukraine. I am actually trying to get Zelensky's regime to understand that it cannot afford to gift Putin's propaganda machine with these things. Putin doubtless will go on saying that Ukraine is Nazi, but it is at least possible to shall we say, remove some of the pit props of that argument.
Simon, in your new book, the World, a Family History, which I highly recommend. It's a really an incredible account that takes you on a journey from past 3,000 years or so. But you have a wonderful section entitled, and I'm going to read it, The Rule of Cock and Cunt, which is devoted to Catherine the Great and Potemkin. And speaking of which, what do you think about the recent news of Russian authorities stealing Potemkin's body?
That very brave of you to say that on a podcast. And but I just want to say, just back to Charles and just say, I mean, Ukraine is now a proper democracy and you know, you're right, there's no place for Bandera as a hero in a westernized liberal democracy. But I just to move on back to Alexander's point. I mean, that is a quote from Frederick the Great, so we're allowed to say it, providing we blame old Fritz for that. And Frederick the Great, as you know, was a sort of misanthropic, a very bitchy misanthropic character who was very threatened by female sexuality and never consummated his marriage. In fact, bullied his wife horribly, the poor woman whom he ignored. And he was a sort of venomous, viperous character, along with being one of the greatest military commanders of all time. But anyway, he hated Catherine the Great and hated the fact that she had this uninhibited sex life, you know, which he regarded as repulsive, and hence his comments about Catherine the Great and Potemkin. In fact, the interesting thing about Catherine the Great was that most of the time, well, certainly with Potemkin, you know, she really chose the most capable minister, and I think in the whole of the Romanov dynasty's rule in the 324 years or whatever it was, or the Romanov dynasty, I think Potemkin was by far the most successful and gifted minister. It was very unusual for a Romanov emperor to allow anybody that sort of that almost royal power that Potemkin had to sort of to decide things. I mean, when you come to someone like Nicholas II at the very end of the dynasty, I mean, he was so jealous of anybody who had any talent that he basically destroyed all the talented ministers at that period, and Witter and others. And that was one of the reasons for his failure. But Catherine,
I think,
was different.
In the book, in the Romanov book especially, you point out kind of this unending parade of backstabbing and intrigue. And at one point, you cannot but commiserate with Alexander III when he could, you know, he would think prone to shouting, "As for the ministers, the devil may take them all." Right?
yeah. But you know, Nicholas II had Stolypin, you know, who was really, I mean, really capable, brilliant minister, who backed by the autocrat, you know, could have achieved massive things. We don't know what, of course, but you know, and it's important not to overstress these things. But you know, he was undermined in all sorts of ways by the state and by the emperor. Anyway, the point was that Catherine the Great was very different, and she really did promote extremely capable people, and Potemkin was the most capable of all of them. So it was a really remarkable partnership. He did have semi-royal powers. I mean, he shared access with her to the treasury, which is pretty close to sort of a share in the autocratic crown as you can get, and you know, they decided everything together, and you know, I think they were as talented as each other. So you know, he's a very interesting case to study, because he's totally unique in the whole empire and the whole dynasty. And but of course, you know, because he had that role, and because he had that special role in New Russia, South Ukraine, and Crimea and the Black Sea, you know, I mean, that's why Putin was fascinated by him. I think the reason why Putin has never really completely embraced Catherine the Great and Potemkin in a way that he has with Peter the Great is, again, the sort of the fact that, you know, the sex life, the aristocratic nature of the regime, the debauchery, the luxury, the extravagance, all of these things are kind of hard to really, are hard to sort of reconcile with modern government, aren't they? And I think he's pretty obsessed with them, but I think he hasn't embraced them completely. But as for the sort of body, I think it's a pretty interesting thing. I mean, I knew from 22 years ago that he was very obsessed with Prince Potemkin and Catherine. But I was amazed that they took the body from Kherson. And but I think that that body is a kind of useful trophy and prize for Putin, because I do think he will do something with it. I do think that will suddenly find out there's a large tomb being built in Moscow with the dates of, I mean, this was actually on his grave. In Kherson. I don't know if any of you have been to Kherson. You probably have. You two have probably both have. Charles hasn't, but Alexander. But on that tomb, it has, if I remember, the gravestone above, you know, above the tomb, it has it's engraved in gold, and it has the names of his battles and cities, and the dates that they were founded or the battles were won. And that is actually quite a useful sort of guide to Putin's justification for this entire war. And so I think that what will happen is, at some point, in a very weird move, but I suppose in quite a natural move, he will unveil some sort of tomb in Moscow, round Red Square, that will have the bones of Potemkin and a sort of tomb thing that just lists, you know, Yekaterinoslav, Dnipro, Odessa, Kherson, so on and so forth, Sebastopol above all, because sacred Sebastopol. And then we'll just name the date, you know, 1783, we'll name the date of the founding of those cities. And that will be the kind of, that will be a kind of shrine to this war and why it was fought. And that's a very sad thing for Potemkin, because, you know, as I said, he was, there's no doubt that Catherine and Potemkin were great Russian imperialists, an idea that is now very unfashionable, obviously, but they were also humanists and like they were highly enlightened, and they couldn't have been less like the sort of cruel nihilism of the and philistinism of today's regime.
And kind of being mindful of time, I do want to ask you kind of to put on the historian's hat and see if you can kind of where this war is heading. One of the kind of, when I'm asked this kind of question, I usually draw parallels maybe with the Crimean War, and kind of maybe it's apropos that it was fought in modern day Ukraine, and ultimately Russia was defeated. So I'm kind of hope, you know, I'm optimistic about the Russian defeat. The question I think is more about what's next. Do we see another era of great reforms?
Right. Well, another era of great reforms. I've no idea. I haven't got a crystal ball, and I think that even if one had a crystal ball, the view would be extremely murky. So I don't know what happens next politically. Militarily, I can hazard a fairly good guess. Russian spring offensive? Well, yes, maybe, but we're actually told it started already. And it's clearly not getting anywhere. Bakhmut, we keep being told, is on the point of falling, and it keeps not falling. You know, Putin actually wanted the place taken by, well, I suppose, tomorrow. As far as I can see, it's not going to get taken by tomorrow. And even if it was, months and months and months of fighting for one very small and very insignificant place, whose capture is strategically fairly meaningless. It would have meant more back before the Russian loss of Izium and all the territory to the north of the salient. Had that still been in Russian hands, well, yeah, taking Bakhmut would have been useful. But there's now much less of a salient to cut off. So I think that the Russian spring offensive, frankly, is going to go nowhere fast. It may take some territory in certain places. I don't think it's going to go very far. The real issue is whether the Ukrainians can amass the military strength necessary to throw the Russians out. I remain rather sceptical about that. I would prefer not to be sceptical about that, but I really think it's going to be quite difficult to throw the Russians out altogether. I wish it were otherwise.
But I think the question I was more aiming to ask you, Charles and Simon, to consider the political developments within Russia as one of the core factor in the ending of this war. So, kind of to build on your point, Ukrainians don't necessarily need to defeat Russian military decisively on the battlefield as such, because we already have seen the Russian military suffering enormous attrition. The question, I think, is more about kind of if we look at the historically at the events of the Crimean War, the Russo-Japanese War, whether the political developments inside Russia can precipitate the end of the war.
Okay, let me speak to that. There's always, I suppose, a chance that someone or other inside the Kremlin, might just launch a coup and take out Putin. Whether that's a possibility, I have no idea. It does seem to me that we should be engaged in a battle for Russian public opinion. I was reading something on the BBC's website only the other day about how many families inside Russia are quite deeply divided, with the younger members of the family, people who, you know, who use the internet, who, you know, who maybe traveled in the West, whatever, much more concerned about the situation, much more worried about the situation, and the older members of the family, people who hark back to the Soviet Union, much more inclined to accept, if you like, the regime's point of view. And this ties into another message which I've been consistently trying to hammer home, which is that you know, we in the West must be aware of this battle. We must avoid talk of destroying Russia, partitioning Russia. We can't march on Moscow. We simply can't do it. And we've got to lead to, if you like, offer the Russian people a way forward in the future. We've got to somehow assure them that there is a way back from this. So, yes, I think that there are issues about public opinion in Russia, but I think that there are things that we need to do about that. We need to work on that split in Russian society, above all by avoiding any talk of, well, as I say, marching on Moscow.
Simon, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just start by saying I loathe it when sloppy Western leaders say we're going to march on Moscow and compare this to 1945. That's foolish talk. But to start from the beginning, I think that, you know, in Russian terms, Russia traditionally has an immense ability to take astonishing punishment from invaders, and for quite serious amounts of time, and in terms of massive losses. And in that, I think of you know, Peter the Great's Great Northern War. You know, it took over 20 years really to finish off, even after a significant victory like Poltava. 1812 which you have both studied, which, you know, actually was part of a sort of cycle of 15 years of warfare, really. And then, of course, you know, in World War One, they took immense punishment for 4 years before they collapsed. And maybe the most kind of relevant is in 1941, you know, when Stalin lost, you know, over 4 million men, you know, in 1 year, and a year of completely, you know, catastrophic command decisions, and yet still managed to start to improve his command and learn to be a fairly competent commander in chief. So those are things we have to bear in mind, because we're only a year into this. So that's one thing. And you know, there's a great quote from Stalin somewhere, where he says, you know, doesn't he realize how vast Russia is? Doesn't he realize that we're not like other countries? The depth of our resources in population, in terms of material and so on. Does he have any idea of the mines, the mountains, the steppes, the tanks, the men? And he says Hitler will never invade. Well, as we know, he did. But the point is that Russia still has resources. In terms of your question, there are examples of Russian defeats leading to political, huge political change. I mean, namely 1904 and 1917, of course. And so your question is very well put. I mean, I personally think I don't have a crystal ball. Many things can happen. And I'm not a military historian like you guys are, but I think that it is possible that Ukraine could win a victory, a full military victory, not necessarily throwing Russia completely out of Donbass, not necessarily out of Crimea, but could win a real victory and a full military victory of some sort would bring about regime change. And that's happened many times in the Tsarist history, which I've written about, or, you know, where serious foreign policy mistakes, blunders. I mean, even without a war, look at Khrushchev, you know, has led to the deposition of, or the fall of a leader in some form. And so I think Ukraine can win properly if given the correct weaponry and of course that other essential quality in all wars, luck. But more likely the West won't give them all the weapons they need. And both sides will become absolutely exhausted by the sort of the brutality and the endurance of this war, and it will get stuck somewhere, and then you'll be in a Korean peninsula or the 1948-49 armistice with Israel and the Arab states, and this will be a war that has just fought repeatedly over the coming years, and it'll be a sort of armistice line which becomes recognized as the border of the state. This is a very touchy subject because no one wants to tell Ukrainians how to negotiate their own war. But these things have happened before and can happen. And that would be a very unsatisfactory solution, but it would still probably give the chance for Ukraine to be built into a prosperous, if fully armed and ever vigilant, Israeli-style democracy, if you like. But I think that if there was a full military defeat, somehow Putin would be destroyed, and then there would be a real opportunity for an age of reforms and a new sort of Russia, if the old one was completely discredited. But that can only happen with full military defeat, whatever that means.
Charles?
Yes, if I could come in on this, Ukraine can do lots of things if the West gives it the weapons it needs, if the West gives it full support. As the two of you may have seen on Twitter in these last couple of days, I've been fighting a ferocious battle with a number of people because I basically condemned the line which had been pushed by Jeremy Corbyn and people like that, saying that there must be an immediate move to peace talks, that peace must be negotiated and so forth. And I simply said, no, absolutely not.
Well, so you were so right. I've been watching that argument, as you know.
Thank you. I am a bloodthirsty Gaul. I am a dangerous idiot. I am a fantasist. I've had people, you know, literally sending me hate mail and slavering at the mouth. But the fact of the matter is there can be no peace talks of any sort without an immediate Russian retreat, at least to the frontiers of 2022. I'd be quite happy to see an armistice which would allow the Russians to do that. I'd be quite happy to see them given a free pass. But there can be no peace negotiations without a return to the frontiers of 2022 at the very least.
I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah. And beyond that, could Ukraine actually reabsorb the Crimea? Could Ukraine really reabsorb the Donbass? I think there are questions there. And I also think that it would be possible to offer the Russians security guarantees. Of course, I dismiss Putin's worries about security as absolute nonsense. NATO is not a threat to him. NATO is not an aggressive organization. But I think it would be possible to think in terms of some sort of non-aggression pact between the West and Russia that would allow things to move forward. The point is, though, to go back to the battle I've been fighting these past couple of days, there are people in the West, there are plenty of people in the West who are desperate for the war to end because of the impact on prices, living costs, all the rest of it. There are people in the West who want the war to end because they are genuinely pacifist. And there are people in the West who want the war to end because, frankly, they sympathize with Putin and his minions. Put all that together, and there is a lot of pressure bubbling away under the surface. And I do believe that that must be resisted heart and soul.
Well, it has been a wonderful 1 hour of discussion, and I want to thank you, Charles, and Simon, for wonderful insights. I am very optimistic about Ukrainian success, both for the sake of Ukraine, but also for the sake of my own homeland of Georgia, since Georgian's future is inherently tied, as is the rest of Eastern Europe's, really, to the success of Ukraine. I want once again thank Alex for hosting us, and I hope we'll have another meeting with good tidings to discuss in the nearest future. Thank you.
Thank you.